Welcome to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim. Here's the good news. We have everybody here. Andy Steiger is here and Chris Battle is
That's
here.
That's good Woo-hoo! News. This is awesome news. Yeah, it's good to be back all together.
Yeah. Feeling loved.
The three amigos.
I wish I had a guitar.
Yeah. If you haven't seen that movie, you should.
Yeah. So, Chris, you found this article?
Yes, kind of. I found it in my inbox, actually, on Facebook. A lovely young lady by the name of Marge.
Shout out to Marge.
Marge, what up? She sent it along to us and wanted us to comment on it. So, by the way, if anybody has something like that that they're looking at and they're curious about and they'd like to hear us talk about, please feel free to email us in at either steve@apologeticscanada.com or chris@apologetics.com, and we'll see if we
apologeticscanada.com.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Did I say apologetics.com?
Yeah,
I always want to leave out the Canada. I think I have that sort of new cultural thing where I want to make everything shorter and tighter. 1 minute videos. That's it. But anyway, so yeah, at apologeticscanada.com, either Chris or Steve, and we'll try to fit it in when we see that it works with it. But at any rate, it's this article about artificial intelligence,
which fits in perfect with today as we want to talk about persons.
Exactly.
It's great.
And so they take this robot and they've named him Android Dick, because they've made him look like — we're going to put this up on the site, but you can watch the little video. It's disturbing just to look at him. He has sort of these funny sort of human characteristics. But at any rate, Philip K. Dick, who is the wrote books such as Blade Runner and whatnot.
Okay. Well, that's kind of apropos. Like as we construct an android, it's like, okay, that's what he looks like.
Yeah. I don't know that I'd ever want somebody to create an android Steiger.
And
I don't know if it'd be good for the world.
Android. get it? Because and E.
Yeah, wow. Thanks for that.
I made a connection there.
It'll take less work to, work on the scalp.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's true. You don't have to put any hair on the robot.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I don't know about you guys, but I get these articles, or I see these articles all the time.
I send it to you from time to time. Hey, Andy.
Hey, take a look at this. It's one of those things that's kind of fascinating, right? I mean, in one hand, for a long time, it was walking was the big thing, right? Like getting, a robot, if you will, to walk. And we've gotten better at that one. Now I think they're trying to do running and they're trying to do stair climbing. It's funny, isn't it? It's one of those things that we do all the time quite quickly and effectively, and
so don't
give much thought
naturally.
Naturally. We don't give a lot of thought to it, but those are actually very complex operations that we do.
Movements, exactly.
Yeah. Well, on a daily basis.
The holy grail is like the hand, right? When they say trying to get a hand that would work with an opposable thumb, that puts the right pressure, that doesn't crush, and all that stuff. A number of years ago, I was watching something, and they said that for them was the hardest thing for robotics to accomplish.
Yeah, probably the mechanical portion. I mean, because there's a lot going on with sensors and all kinds of things that we have. Well, the mechanics of it is one thing, but the brains is a whole nother, is a whole separate realm of difficulty. How do you get a computer to think? And what does that even mean? What does that look like? And so what you have then is you have all these different companies that are working actually quite hard at it. I was reading some articles where there's a lot of big companies like Google and others that are investing tons of money into this field. Well, this one just recently was posted by PBS Nova. I guess it was a report that they were doing, and they were interviewing the robot, actually, and trying to have a conversation with them. Now, I have to admit, I've become quite jaded. I have one friend who loves this kind of stuff, and he just thinks it's the coolest stuff ever. For me, I've just become very jaded to it, in that I now know what I'm looking at and what I'm reading. And once you start realizing what you're looking at and what you're reading, it really starts to — the glisten of it starts to fade. You start to realize this isn't as cool as you think it is.
Yeah, it's very much sort of inflated out of proportion, like the implications of it.
Right? Oh, and this is something that you almost feel bad for a lot of scientists, but they have to do this in many ways.
Right.
Because a lot of their grants are dependent on what they've accomplished with the money that's already been given to them. And they want to make things as grandiose as possible to gain public interest and to gain more grant money and so that they can continue to do their thing. But let's just take a moment to talk about the king who has no clothes on. And let's just take a moment, just kind of, you know, what are we actually looking at here? And what you find is that in the coding, if you will, in the creating of these robots or these artificial intelligence, what has been done here is quite sophisticated and is very, very complicated. But what it is its word matching. So let's talk about this a little bit, because we do this in different ways. We even do this with dogs, for example, because you can ask the question, okay, does a dog know what language is? You know, because when I tell my dog to sit down, he sits down. Hmm. So does my dog know
what the words sit down mean, like the meaning behind the words?
Right.
Or are they responding to sort of auto response? Like, I've done this when he's made this sort of sounds before. I've done this, and then he's given me
this. Exactly. And this is Pavlov's, you know, dog is a prime example of this.
Ring the bell.
And ring the bell.
Start salivating because they're so used to getting the food when the bells rang.
That's right. This famous experiment. Mm-hmm.
Conditioning? It's called some sort of conditioning.
I think so.
And ultimately, that's exactly what you're doing, because what the dog is hearing is he's hearing you make sounds. And he knows that when you make a certain sound and it sits down, like you said, he's going to get a treat or he's going to be rewarded in some fashion. And then this becomes a behavior that he realizes you want him to do. Mm-hmm. But does he understand what's happening? Does he understand what the word sit means? Well, as scientists have gone about this and have studied this, the conclusion is absolutely not. They don't understand language, and they don't understand the meaning of what's taking place. By the way, wish I could remember this. This all got started, I believe it was in the 1800s. There was a horse. There was a horse that would respond to math
with like
questions.
Tapping.
Yeah, with tapping. Hmm. And that's what really got this whole thing started, with scientists wanting to to go, okay, does this horse actually know math or what's taking place here? I'll remember it and we'll post it online. So if you want to, there's a whole Wikipedia thing on it, and you can
it's awesome.
Check it.
The horse was actually responding to like almost imperceptible movements of his owner.
Yeah, because the owner actually wasn't trying to trick.
No, he got tricked. He legitimately thought that the horse could do these tricks, but the horse was responding to him. The owner was affirming him in a way that he didn't even know that he was doing. So it was like a tell.
Was giving him the answer.
You know what I mean? Gamblers talk about tells, right? You can sort of tell when a person is bluffing or whatever.
Right.
And so he knew that he was doing something that the owner liked and therefore was going to get like a sugar cube or what have you.
So how does this work then with this robot, this artificial intelligence? What you have is you have sophisticated coding that is listening, right? You know, you got these microphones that are picking up, you know, sound waves. And when sound waves peak and they have the, you know, different shapes, that's being recognized as code, that you know, the words that are coming out of my mouth have certain they look a certain way on graphs with regards to the way my sound waves are looking, and those sound waves are being interpreted as digital data, and then that digital information is being paired up with other information that has been coded. So if you get this kind of sound wave, how are you doing? Right. Well, then here is an appropriate response. Mm-hmm. You know, I am well. And so the coder needs to code that in there. Mm-hmm. When you get these sound waves that create this digital, you know, information, well, it pairs up with this response.
So in effect, what we have is not so much self-awareness in the robot or like true intelligence, but
there's absolutely no self-awareness. There is no true intelligence.
Right. But that's how it is being portrayed as, yeah, right? That's right. The impression that we're given. But what we're actually having is just a mere illusion of self-awareness or intelligence by way of having these interactions that go in a predictable way.
Exactly. And this it's speech recognition. Right. Pure and simple.
Yeah. What it's become is just made speech recognition more complicated in that now we're pairing answers to the speech recognition. But this isn't anything new. Like if what we're seeing, scientists have thought about, philosophers have thought about for a long time, and in fact have come up with different thought experiments with how to understand it. Steve, you want to explain to everybody the Chinese room?
Yeah, the Chinese room. Actually, before Chinese room, there was this guy, Alan Turing, who he was a Nobel laureate. I think it was in physics, but what he said
in fact, there was a movie recently made about him.
About him? Okay, I didn't
yeah,
know about
what,
that.
What's that movie?
Ex Machina? Turing. Oh, that's right. With the... he was
with Cumberbatch
like,
or whatever.
Yeah, Benedict Cumberbatch. And it's like the
Imitation Game.
Yeah. Anyway. Is a movie that's recently been made about Turing.
Okay, so that's about Turing. Okay, Alan Turing was a Nobel laureate, as I understand it. I'm not sure exactly in what field. I think it was in physics. But anyway, what he said was that he proposed a test. Like, how do we know that, say, a robot or whatever has self-awareness or intelligence, like true intelligence? He said, well, if we can be convinced that this thing is self-aware, then it's self-aware.
And this has become called the Turing test.
Turing test, which...
And so the Turing test is simply have a conversation with something that with an artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And if you can't tell whether or not that's an actual, you know, computer speaking to you or a person behind the computer, well, then it's passed.
It's passed. Now then what happens is... the thought experiment, Chinese room, comes in. And this is basically how it works. I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit, but the basic idea is there. Let's say, Chris, you are in China, right? Okay, and you lock yourself up in a room. Mm-hmm. Okay, and
lock you up in a room.
Or something along those lines. Don't worry, we won't take your kidneys away.
I can see that.
A little more plausible. Yeah.
So what happens is you lock yourself in a room, or Andy locks you in a room, and you have a book. Everything that you need to know about Chinese, right, is right there. So you know that when you have a certain set of Chinese characters, you can look through the book.
All you need to see is those characters and match characters with other
characters. Match characters with other characters. So the other characters would be then the response, basically, right? So let's say there is a lovely Chinese gal outside the room. She throws a number of these characters under your door saying, hi, how are you, right? And you take these set of characters, you put it all together, look through the book, and you string together the correct response, and then you throw it back out the door, right?
So it's like an ATM in swords. People are putting things in, and you're spitting things back out.
Right. Mm. So then the Chinese gal outside the room takes the characters that you just threw out and goes, wow, this guy is really Chinese. But then when she opens the door and walks into the room, she sees that you are not Chinese.
I'm not Chinese.
Right. So this is the Chinese
you
room.
You can confirm you are definitely not Chinese. Just
thought experiment. So what this is basically saying is that the Chinese gal outside the room had this impression that, yeah, certainly this, whatever's inside here must be a Chinese man or, you know, woman, who knows these days, right? But,
too soon.
So, but when she goes inside the room, it's not at all what she expected. In fact, you didn't even have to know Chinese, right? All you needed to do was go by the book, namely the coding, just take the set of characters, you know what other set of characters go with it, and you just spit out the response.
So the question then becomes, if a computer's doing this, does the computer actually know Chinese?
Right.
Right? Or with what we're talking about, if a computer's able to imitate things that are similar to a conscious being, does that actually mean that they're conscious?
Does that make them a person?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then ultimately the question is, well, would that make them a person? Now, currently... the machines that do this, and even when you watch the video, you'll see it's very sloppy. It's not done well, clear, this robot would not pass the Turing test.
No. The guy is over enunciating his words, and it's like he's talking to a small child.
Right.
But then he's laughing at it, and it's clear he knows it's not a person. He's not treating it like a person.
Well, and even at one point, he asked the guy who did the coding, you know, did you code these answers?
Yeah.
And he said, yes, some of these, but some of them it's getting on the web.
Right.
But
all of that even is programmed in, right?
That's
that
right.
You can go on to the web and pull some information together so you can spit out the response.
It like sets traps almost just to apprehend the right responses.
So then our question is, the big question is, what's going on inside of that brain of this robot, right? Is it like the Chinese room, right? And
this was something... I saw an article that was interesting on this subject recently, mm-hmm. where there's an actual company out there. Again, maybe we can post this article, but they went and found different, you know, people who were doing similar experiments with their artificial intelligence. One of them was a computer that could identify like animals in pictures and different things. It could identify what was going on in a mm-hmm. picture. What was interesting was they just went around to trick these things to demonstrate to you that it's coding, that this thing isn't thinking. And one of the things that they did is they could give the computer these pixelated images that were actual just random. To us they look like random dots, but in fact they were code. And so it thought it was a bird, mm-hmm. right? Because they were able to trick it. Because what they were doing was they were tricking the code. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, this was just to demonstrate, listen, consciousness is far more complicated than you think it is. I mean, so in a similar way, they could trick this AI mm-hmm. and give out certain sound waves, right? And it's going to trick the code into thinking that it's giving the right responses. But ultimately, it doesn't. This is the big question. It doesn't understand.
Right.
Right. It's not aware of what's taking place.
There isn't a person in there.
Right. In which we're able to see when something's working correctly and when something's not working correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot to talk about this issue, and we've kind of taken up our time.
That's actually a good segue into the topic of personhood. I'll just let you take away.
Sure. The topic of personhood is one of those budding fields. Mm-hmm. And I know that might kind of sound surprising since it's something so intuitive to us, but it's one of those things that we've really taken for granted for a long time. And now we're starting to realize that, you know, as we go into more of neuroscience and questions about what we are, we're needing to try to answer. And it's not as easy to answer as we thought it would be.
Do you see a need also coming out of the implications from the sort of worldview that we seem to be adopting as a society as well? Like that, because it seems to me like before the need wasn't there because everyone sort of had this implicit understanding. But now, like, what would you say to that?
Well, that's absolutely the case. So one of the things that took place out of the Enlightenment is science became a dominant view in our thinking. In fact, it began to take first place and began to become a mode by which we interpreted everything else. So that in the end, science became kind of the trump card. Ultimately, this would lead to logical positivism. If you don't know what that is, you can go Google that.
Yep.
But ultimately, it's the idea that this idea that science is the ultimate trump card and that by it we determine what all truth is.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is logical positivism dies according to its own death, because
right.
if the scientific method is the standard by which all truth is determined, well, it fails to its own standard. It's not, that statement can't be scientifically proven through
right.
the scientific method. And so it died, but it really didn't fully die. It still lingers, and it lingers in the idea of reductionism, that at the end of the day, everything is physical, and that science deals with the physical, so that science really, in the mind of the postmodern thinker, science is the only way to find truth, if there is any truth.
Mm-hmm.
So you have like two camps, one that just has adopted this idea that there's no truth,
mm-hmm.
which again is self-refuting, because you seem to think it's true that there's no truth. But then there's this other camp that seems to be gaining momentum, and that's just the idea that if there is any truth to be found, science is really the only way to find it.
Right.
And you find it through, again, this idea of reducing things to their simplest form. And so that you have two main ways of knowing what something is. And this is important to our discussions today. So the two main ways that you understand what something is what it's made up of and the mechanical forces operating on it.
Right.
And this becomes the universe, right? The universe is made up of physical things with mechanical forces operating on those things. And so
that assumes a whole lot of things.
Right. Yeah. But ultimately the scientific community today, many, in this reductionist camp would just say that that's actually all that really exists is just physical stuff and mechanical forces operating on that physical stuff. And that's it. Yeah. Well, what happens once you start to do that? Well, as we went along in this kind of thinking, we began to realize that this excludes certain things, as you're saying, Steve. Mm-hmm. This excludes anything that's non-physical, and it excludes something that doesn't seem to operate on mechanical forces. And as soon as that thinking began to pick up steam, human persons were squared up in the sight lines, mm-hmm. right? Because that is what a person is. A person is something that is non-physical that seems to be operating outside of these mechanical forces. And I'll explain that in a second. And so what you have is in a large way in the scientific community, we've talked a lot about this, but as you know, these things can come up in different discussions, but the idea that simply persons don't exist then, mm-hmm. right? Because if all you have is physical stuff and mechanical forces, then people must not actually exist.
It's just an illusion that we get, much like the Turing test, right? It's mm-hmm. just what we perceive it to be, but at the most basic level, all it is just, you know, electrical impulses and matter colliding.
Right. We're just a different type of code.
Right.
Right. Now, this gets more complicated as we get into this. But not all scientists have agreed with this or have liked this. Mm-hmm. There's been other scientists like Michael Polanyi, for example, and others that have said, no. Maybe we shouldn't be starting from our science. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should actually start from the viewpoint that I'm actually a person and I actually do exist. And there is this thing called personhood and it is non-physical. And then maybe I should start there. Mm-hmm. And then maybe instead of starting from science and working my way to the conclusion that I don't exist,
bottom up, yeah,
which is absurd. Yeah, maybe I should start with I do exist, I am a person, and then start working my way back to science.
So it's like a presuppositional scientific method kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess you could say it is.
Yeah, because science starts with the presupposition that, you know, not even the presupposition so much, but its methodology is basically naturalistic.
Yeah.
Right? So it doesn't even... it doesn't even have the resources within its enterprise to go outside of its bounds to look at something that's non-physical.
So this becomes an interesting reason why AI is of such interest to the mm-hmm. scientific community. Because if everything is just physical, then you should be able to code consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But problematically, we have yet to be able to accomplish it, mm-hmm. and we're beginning to realize that it is far more complicated than we originally thought it was.
Yeah, just like when they ever make any sort of discovery that can somehow exclude God from the circumstances, right? Like, for instance, when the Big Bang happened, I know there's a number of them kind of went, woo, right? We have an explanation, in a sense, for whatever, but it just turned out that the theists quickly figured out that was... William Lane Craig, it's an argument in favor of
right.
when we think of things like the Kalam cosmological argument.
Yeah, in fact, Sir Fred Hoyle, he's the one who coined the term Big Bang as sort of a pejorative name.
This was an atheist that coined the term Big Bang, and it was actually a Christian physicist who determined that
George Lemaitre.
Yeah, that the universe was expanding and it had a beginning. It was the atheist community that didn't appreciate it mm-hmm. and coined this term that was actually
Big Bang.
pejorative. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, because they realize that it gave great evidence that God actually does exist. This is how personhood is such a good argument for God's existence or as well, mm-hmm. is because ultimately what you have when you look at the Kalam cosmological argument, which we were looking at a few podcasts ago, and we were talking about how that this leads to personhood. And the way that this leads to personhood is in the idea that if you have only two things, that is the physical and mechanical forces operating on the physical, mm-hmm. it raises the question, how did physical stuff come into being? Mm-hmm. Because there wouldn't have been, before the Big Bang, there was nothing physical.
Nothing physical. No matter, no energy, no time, no space, nothing like that at all.
And then that raises the question, okay, were there any mechanical forces? And if there were any mechanical forces,
then there is something.
Right. And on top of that, it means that the universe would just have naturally existed.
Eternally.
Because whatever that, you know, mechanical force that would have taken place and the universe would have been created. But why is it that the universe came into existence 13 billion years ago?
There has been a change. I hesitate to use the word change because usually when we talk about change, we're talking about time, mm-hmm. right? But there was a point at which nothing existed. No universe existed. And then there is a point at which the universe does exist. So why that flip, so to speak?
Now, the only time that we see anything equivalent to that is this idea of something coming into existence with no mechanical force behind it is with regards to persons. Mm. That persons are able to do this. That persons seem to fit the category that's required for whatever created the universe. So, for example, that whatever that created the universe needed to be immaterial, it needed to be incredibly powerful, and it needed to be able to operate at its own will. It needed to have free will. It needed to be able to create if it's not some sort of mechanical force. Mm-hmm. Right?
And that's what Al-Ghazali.
That's right.
That was his, piece de resistance for his Kalam argument when he said that for this sufficient cause to be sufficient, it needed to be personal because otherwise it would, what would change? The example I know Bill Craig uses is for, a sufficient cause for water to freeze is for the temperature to be below zero degrees centigrade.
And there's a mechanical force.
Right.
There's a good example of a mechanical force.
Exactly. And that's a sufficient cause. But if the cause of the universe was just always there, mm-hmm. right? Say it was always below 0 degrees centigrade, then everything would always just be freezing. So what mm-hmm. makes it go from nothing to something? It needs to be a will, a personal will.
What makes it, go from being frozen to thawing?
Yeah. Right? Or not. Yeah. Or to go from non-freezing, like mm-hmm. running water to whatever. Something needs to drop the temperature. Yeah.
If we want to use that analogy, mm-hmm. The universe currently would be in liquid form and it's moving to frozen mm-hmm. form, right? As it loses energy, it's experiencing...
To use the same illustration.
Illustration. It's experiencing the heat death that I think we've talked about before.
Yeah.
So it raises that question, well, what is standing outside of time that seems to be able to create... It seems to be able to cause. This becomes a crucial idea, an uncaused cause. What is able to create at its own will? The only thing that we have ever observed that is able to do this is a person. Now the question of timelessness, that would be another question in philosophers' debate about that. Is God mm-hmm. sitting inside of time, outside of time? That's a whole nother question. Mm-hmm. But the only thing that we know of that seems to be non-physical and has the capability of free will, of being able to cause anything, is a person. Now, we live in a culture today that wants to say, no, persons are physical and they operate on mechanical forces. This is, by the way, in the video, they bring this up, mm-hmm. where the robot, if you will, is saying, yeah, I'm not that different from you. You know, we all are just operating off of the forces.
To a degree, we are all acting out of some kind of a programming that we have, right? Just to paraphrase.
Right. And the programming that our secular culture would say that we have is two sorts of programming. Mm. One would be the Big Bang, mm-hmm. and that's just simply you are particles in motion.
Physical determinism.
Yeah, physical determinism. And the second one would be natural selection.
Right.
That there is this, this programming of survival that you have that affects you. But ultimately, all of these things can be boiled down to the physical.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that was a good discussion. Let's wrap it up there. We'll come back with more next week. Thank you for joining us, listeners. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll see you next week.